One day, early in 1918, an expert committee met in London to discuss the development of some new devices for the detection and destruction of submarines. At that time, in the World War at Sea, the German U-boats were sending a disturbing number of Allied ships to the bottom. A key member of the committee was one of the great pioneers of nuclear physics, Ernest Rutherford. On that particular day, however, he failed to attend the meeting. His absence was deplored, for this was no ordinary routine meeting. He was asked for an explanation, politely but firmly. He gave it, firmly and directly, in these words.
"Talk softly, please. I've been engaged in experiments which suggest that the atom can be artificially disintegrated. If it is true, it is of far greater importance than a war."
United Nations Radio presents Predicament at Dawn, a program about the problems, possibilities, and patterns of cooperation in a world being reshaped by science.
First of all, the question is there a predicament? And if there is, what is it? We submit the following situation, which may strike you as a little far-fetched and fanciful. In actual fact, it is simply uncommon. Our presentation is based upon reported fact. Citizen X of country Y is essentially a nervous type. Apprehensions grip him more frequently and with greater strength than is normal in his community. At the moment, he's responding to them with some reconstruction work in the basement of his house.
That should do it. Should be strong enough for the average blast. Of course, if it hits within 5 miles of us, well, too bad. Now, dear, did you bring all the supplies down?
Yes, I think they're all here.
Good. Let's take an inventory.
Right. One pick, one shovel.
For tunneling out or burrowing deeper.
Canned food, vitamin pills.
For balanced diet for 8 weeks or earlier if heavy rain reduces external radioactivity.
Packets of vegetable seeds.
For planting in any uncontaminated soil outside after we emerge.
Water tank.
For ration of 2 quarts per person per day.
One battery-operated radio and batteries.
For contact with any transmitter that may remain on the air.
2 kerosene lamps, candles, flashlights.
For countering depressing effect of prolonged darkness.
Books, magazines, chess set.
For countering mental lethargy.
3 changes of clothing per person.
For maintenance of morale.
1 portable Geiger counter.
For checking efficiency of air filter and outside environment when we emerge.
A survival kit for Citizen X and his family. Very few of us, even in these uncertain times, would go to such extreme lengths. But his elaborate precautions do illustrate the nature of our basic predicament at this dawn of a new age. The social historian might explain it this way.
We're a curiously ambivalent species. While dinosaurs, dodos, and other defunct creatures are now found only in natural history museums, we've managed to survive because we're remarkably well equipped, biologically and psychologically. As individuals, there can be no argument about that. But since there are so many of us, we've been forced to adapt our talents for individual survival to the requirements of group survival. And this is where we're not so talented. We don't do too badly at the level of the local community, but when the group is the nation, we can get ourselves into some pretty messy situations, like civil war. Finally, at the international, the world level, our talent for group survival can be, well, rather primitive.
Now, of course, once upon a time, this didn't matter very much. In the days when war was rather sporty and knights were bold, the gallant fellow could gallop along a country lane in search of conflict, see a bucolic fellow digging turnips in a field, pull up his horse, and ask charmingly innocent questions.
Tell me, my good man, which way to the battle?
Straight ahead for half a mile. Turn left by the oak tree, then over the hill. Reckon they must all be lined up for now, if they're going to be done with it for nightfall.
Thank you, my good man. Giddy up.
By nightfall, a few broken heads, some blood on the grass, and honor vindicated. And what's more, a high survival index. But today, the gallant knight has changed into the missile-borne megaton bomb, and into subtler means for mass extinction. Dr. Brock Chisholm, former Director General of the World Health Organization, has written,
"There are many possible biological weapons. Botulinus toxin is probably the most widely known. But influenza, brucellosis, tularemia, psittacosis, hoof and mouth disease, plague, cholera, smallpox, typhus, wheat rust, and many others have been experimented with. It is theoretically and perhaps practically possible by laboratory methods to increase the virulence of some of these agents to such an extent that they could break through the natural or artificially acquired immunities which now hold them in check. Whether or not this has been done is not known outside of highly restricted circles."
And to bombs and biologicals, add chemicals. Newspapers have recently reported the availability of certain agents known as anticholinesters, or nerve gases. How do they work? Press reports say,
"They interfere with the functioning of a chemical in a nervous system called choline, which is a vital link in the transmission of impulses from the brain to the body."
What are their effects?
Well, in liquid form, some of these nerve gases will kill almost instantly if as little as one drop touches the skin. Now, others act on muscles. They can relax them so completely that the body becomes paralyzed, or get the same effect by making them extremely rigid. Or you can mix the two effects and produce a sort of shaking palsy. Still another can destroy an individual's will to think, or even communicate with others.
Are there any antidotes? Can you do anything about it if a drop does fall on your skin?
Technically, yes. There are known antidotes, but in some cases they have to be applied within 30 seconds of exposure to the gas, which makes it a bit difficult when large populations are involved.
So, the odds, it appears, are not very good. The chances these days of maintaining any sort of survival index, high or low, would seem to be pretty slim, should we decide to pull out all the stops and attempt to settle our differences with bombs, bugs, and little bottles of gas. Our predicament is sharp and urgent. And realizing it, some people tend to make science the scapegoat. Isn't the bomb simply a technological application of pure physics? Isn't the ballistic missile simply a technological application of the physical laws of flight, of aerodynamics? Aren't nerve gases the result of chemical research? Enough, runs the not uncommon argument. Let the dogs sleep on, lest some meddlesome experimenter works a change in them, lest they rise as the dogs of war to cry the final havoc. For two reasons, the argument seems hardly fair. One concerns our talent for group survival, as reflected in our social and political institutions. We shall come to it later. The other is the obvious one, that the applications of science need not be, and indeed are not, exclusively negative and destructive. So obvious, in fact, that it's easy to overlook it.
A new world is coming into being before our very eyes, yet men seem unaware of it.
A quote from a recent speech by a distinguished philosopher, Professor Gaston Berger, director of higher education in France and president of the French National Commission for UNESCO. We quote again.
"Before us lie unknown dangers, undreamed of adventures and countless inventions, the embryos of countless others, disquieting but grandiose and full of promise. That is the new world towards which we march."
Professor Berger made his speech in the great conference hall at UNESCO's new headquarters in Paris. He and seven others, distinguished in such fields as agronomy, biology, chemistry, physics, and physiology, had been invited by the organization to express their thoughts, freely and as individuals, in a roundtable discussion on science and mankind. Each in the depth of his knowledge could sense the disquieting dangers. Each in the breadth of his horizon could understand the predicament. But each found it possible to speak with confidence about the dawn. Hear first the chairman of their discussion, Lord Boyd Orr of the United Kingdom, first Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, and a great scientific fighter in the battle against hunger. He reminds us of the broad front on which we're advancing.
What has caught the imagination of the people of the world is the release of atomic energy and the talk about the atomic age. But other branches of science have advanced, science in agriculture and psychology and medicine and so on, and these advances are as great and as difficult and as important as the advances in physics and chemistry. Owing to the advances in medical science, 30 years had been added to the average length of life of children born today compared with infants born 50 years ago. Therefore, we would call it not the atomic age, it's the scientific age, the age of new science which has been developed in the last 30 or 40 years.
To the round table from the Soviet Union came Professor Nikolai Semenyov, winner of the Nobel Prize for Chemistry and director of the Institute of Physics and Chemistry at the Soviet Academy of Sciences. From the immediate past and the present, he looks ahead.
Но сейчас я хочу, в соответствии, собственно говоря, с тем, как этот день планировался, немножко помечтать о будущем, при том близком будущем, науке и ее применении.
I would like to dream aloud a little about the future and not such distant future as that. Physicists will unquestionably master controlled atomic reactions, thus providing a source of unlimited power in any place of the globe. Chemists will understand the behavior of organic matter, explain the basic features of organic and non-organic matter, of heredity, etc. Among further leaps in science, I would like to mention a deeper understanding of heart activity, tumors. In agriculture, new types of plants and animal life will be created. Artificial, synthetic foods will become widespread. Machines will be built which will replace muscular activity, freeing mankind of heavy physical labor. Even more or less automatic mental activity could be mechanically reproduced. There will be needed only a minimum of time for labor, while the well-being will be at a maximum. The possibilities will be unlimited for education for all, thus enabling great development of human personality.
From India to the round table came Homi Jahangir Bahaba, director of the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, Bombay, chairman of India's Atomic Energy Commission, and president of the UN's first Atoms for Peace Conference, Geneva, 1955. Looking at part of the predicament, the danger of too little food for too many people, he gave this view.
Modern science permits hunger to be abolished from the entire world. In India, and in many countries of Asia, the productivity of agriculture per man remains the same as it has been for centuries. This shows that a mere application of present knowledge and techniques in these countries could easily solve the food problem in these areas. It is lavish use of fertilizer made possible and produced by modern industrial processes which is responsible for the greater productivity of the soil. Here we see directly the impact of the chemical industry, namely the production of fertilizer, on the productivity of agriculture. Now, the rate at which the production of food can be increased is far greater than the rate at which the population increases, which is 1.3% per annum in India. I emphasize this point because many people are under the misapprehension that the overpopulation and the increase in population in the underdeveloped areas is the cause of their low standard of living. This is clearly not so. Even with an increasing population, modern technology enables one to raise the standard of living of the people as a whole, because the rate of increase of production is much greater, or can be much greater, than the rate of increase of population.
As the discussion progressed, the details of the Dawn came into clearer and clearer focus. Bernardo Jussé of Argentina, one of the creators of endocrinology, the science of hormones, and William Noyes, the distinguished American chemist, spoke of research in nucleic acids, which points to the possibility of influencing heredity. Professor Blackett of the United Kingdom, originator of a technique known as operational research, by which executives acquire a scientific basis for making practical decisions, spoke of the role of science in closing the gap between the rich and poor nations of the world. Others spoke of the potential in medicine, nutrition, natural resources, and the social sciences. A rich feast was prepared for that round table, more than could possibly be condensed or digested in this brief program. So we'll confine ourselves to one more excerpt. Professor Semenyoff, you remember, said he wanted to dream aloud about the future, and we've heard part of his dream. Here is how it culminated.
The ideal is to create a happy life for all, not just for the few, not for one people, but for all peoples, without regard for race, creed, or nationality. And now there are real foundations for these possibilities. Enrichment of the few at the expense of others is considered by many, even now, to be immoral, and it must be rejected. In fact, the main obstacle to happy life on Earth is not in the scientific limitations, but in the public order.
We're back with our predicament. In the light of the new dawn, our capacity for public order, our talent for group survival, falls short of our requirements. Our social and political machinery has an efficiency rating that's only fair. It's still subject to breakdown under stress, and this we can't afford anymore. It's much too dangerous. So, what's the sensible thing to do? Does science itself have the answer?
In the welter of conflicting fanaticisms, one of the few unifying forces is scientific truthfulness.
These are the words of the famous mathematician and philosopher Bertrand Russell.
By this I mean the habit of basing our beliefs upon observations and inferences as impersonal and as much divested of local and temperamental bias as is possible for human beings. This philosophical method can be extended to the whole sphere of human activity, producing a lessening of fanaticism with an increasing capacity for sympathy and mutual understanding.
Now, what's the implication here? A world governed by scientists? A sort of 20th century echo of Plato's Parliament of Philosophers? Probably not. Even if such a thing were desirable, it's hardly practicable. But since science and human affairs are now so closely welded, the world can certainly learn much from the spirit and practice of science. We recall the caption to an old stereotype picture. Surrounded by retorts, test tubes, Bunsen burners and bottles, a man stands, wild of eye and shaggy of hair. In his hand, a surgeon's knife.
Give me your heart, dear. I'm making a monster.
The mad scientist, Dr. Frankenstein in a dark tower. It never was a good likeness. The scientist's search for truth may involve the domination of matter, but never men. And he cannot conduct his search in isolation. The success of his work demands the open and searching scrutiny of his colleagues. It was ever thus. Hence the great tradition of scientific cooperation, a tradition that has most certainly suffered from periodic interruptions. The secretive demands of war can amount to an almost total eclipse. But it has always risen free again, like the phoenix. And today, in the face of our predicament, there is evidence that it's taking on new and firmer forms.
New patterns for international collaboration are being constructed and tested. Some will enjoy success, and perhaps others will fail. But at least, men are rising to the challenge to provide opportunity to acquire benefits that international collaboration can provide.
That was Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner, president of the International Council of Scientific Unions, a body created by the scientists of the world themselves in 1932 as a point of contact between the academies and research councils of different countries. It was through the ICSU that most memorable exercise in cooperation, the International Geophysical Year, was first discussed. And the IGY, at the strictly technical level, was without doubt a magnificent example of the new patterns, patterns which can best be described as organized cooperation, as distinct from the valuable but generally spasmodic cooperation of the past. But there are many more examples, and some of them have sprung directly from political initiatives. They are direct reflections of the modern links between science, technology, and international affairs.
There is a way. There are ways. Out of bondage and away from fear. There is a course open to us. A course which will lead us away from the fear-laden anxiety of competitive military buildup.
This is Mr. Sterling Cole, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
It is a way by which constructive action can overcome the paralysis of exclusive dependence upon preparing for war in order to prevent war. History has shown that periods of balanced military power do not provide the dependable foundation for the permanent peace that we desire. Today we have an alternative course. We can relieve the pressure of dangerously competitive military preparation by turning our energies to constructive international operation, real joint operation by nations, action, not talk. That course is a conscious, concerted, coordinated effort to apply the benefits of modern technology to the welfare of mankind with something like the intensity and effectiveness with which we divert and distort the product of science to the demands of war. It is a course along which patriotism can be as productive for peace as it is preempted for war.
The Atomic Energy Agency, formally established by resolution of the nations assembled at UN headquarters in New York in 1956. Its prime purpose, informally expressed, to help guarantee that the atom shall serve and not slaughter mankind. But this is but part of a complex whole. Today, a wide spectrum of techno-social and techno-political problems are abroad. Consider some of them, and the response to them, both within and without the UN.
Radiation, from stratospheric fallout to shoe-fitting fluoroscopes.
Response, the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Members from 15 countries.
Detection of nuclear tests as a step towards control.
Response, the meetings of experts in Geneva to evolve techniques. Members from 8 countries.
Outer space, tomorrow's arena for old rivalries or rich adventure.
Response, the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, technical and legal. Members from 18 countries.
Basic research, meeting the cost when resources are limited.
Response, the European Center for Nuclear Research at Geneva, sparked by UNESCO in 1950, built by 12 countries in partnership, open to all countries.
Health and hunger, forecasts and flight plans, education and technical aid.
Response, all the specialized agencies of the United Nations and the UN itself, each in its own allotment, but each part of the other. Membership virtually universal. Forty-five years ago, in 1914, a man in England wrote a book. It was the sort of book that, in those days, was described as an imaginative romance. Today, it would probably be called science fiction. Yet the author's mind and the book he wrote had qualities worthy of better labels. The book was called The World Set Free. The author was H.G. Wells. Echoing clearly still after 45 years is this passage.
Nothing could have been more obvious to the people of the early 20th century than the rapidity with which war was becoming impossible. And as certainly, they did not see it. They did not see it until the atomic bombs burst in their fumbling hands. The catastrophe of the bombs, which shook men out of cities and businesses and economic relations, shook them also out of their old established habits of thought and out of the lightly held beliefs and prejudices that came down to them from the past.
Have events and realities confirmed the Wellsian prognosis? In this program, we've set down some evidence. Evidence of how science and technology are increasingly a vital influence in international affairs. It may be that, in the years ahead, the promotion of peace will have an almost exclusively technical character. But can we say that the organizations, the instruments, the agencies so far evolved to meet the new dawn are adequate to the task? Within them, deep-seated conflicts still reside. The deadlock and the stalemate can still impede our progress. Yet we have evolved them. They do exist. And not so long ago, they didn't. The only honest, though incomplete, conclusion is that our predicament remains unresolved. In our attitude towards it, both the pessimist and the optimist can still put up a case. But the men of science who sat at the UNESCO round table in Paris were unanimous in optimism.
Ladies and gentlemen, it can be done. I believe it will be done. I'm an optimist.
This, once again, is the chairman of that historic discussion, Lord Boyd Orr.
I'm getting an old man, but I hope to live to see the dawn of the wonderful new age, when war and the fear of war has been abolished, hunger abolished, disease abolished, when all the nations are working together in cooperation and in friendship and the common brotherhood of all men.
Having come so far and survived, what a pity it'd be if we disappointed the chairman and all his colleagues in all the sciences in all the lands. And indeed, ourselves.
You have been listening to Predicament at Dawn, a program concerning the problems, possibilities, and patterns of cooperation in the scientific age. This program was written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.